You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely like a feminist before, but I definitely remain very much a feminist now after having experienced, you know, going to the sort of other side of sex apartheid and realising all the attendant benefits of being on the other side.
Welcome back to the Wheeler Centre podcast. In this episode, lawyer, advocate and Next Chapter recipient Sam Elkin launches his memoir with a night of celebration at the Wheeler Centre, hosted by Eve Rees.
Hello everyone and welcome to this Wheeler Centre event to celebrate the publication of Sam Elkin's debut memoir, Detachable Penis, A Queer Legal Saga. My name is Eve Rees. I'm a historian and a writer, and I'm going to be hosting tonight and in conversation with Sam this evening. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we meet on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land. We're gathering tonight on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country, a place that's been the site for storytelling and creativity for tens of thousands of years. We're honoured to be guests on this country and to continue its long tradition of coming together to share stories and ideas. We pay our respects to Kulin elders past and present, as well as any First Nations people who might be with us in the room this evening. Given the subject matter of tonight's discussion, I'd also like to acknowledge the long history of gender diversity on this continent. Here in so-called Australia, as around the world, the gender binary was imposed alongside colonisation. First Nations peoples have their own understandings of gender, which continue to thrive into the present and from which we settlers have so much to learn. I extend a special welcome to any brother boys or sister girls here tonight. Finally, I also want to acknowledge that we come together in the context of an ongoing genocide in Gaza. I know it can feel hard to celebrate amidst so much death and suffering. I know that Sam has been staunch in his commitment to Palestinian liberation, and I'd like to express our solidarity with the student encampments for Gaza that are proliferating across the country, including just up the road at the University of Melbourne. Very inspiring. But in dark times like these, we need more than ever truth tellers and artists who are willing to document and challenge and reimagine the world we live in. Tonight, we're here to celebrate a book that does just that. Detachable Penis is a triumphant literary debut written by one of the very best humans, Sam Elkin. Sam is a lawyer, writer, and radio maker. Born in England and raised on unceded Noongar land, Sam currently lives on unceded Wurundjeri land near the Maribyrnong River. He is a co-host of 3RRR radio show Queer View Mirror and the ABC History Listens' Crossing Time, a history of transgender Australia. Sam's essays have been published in Kill Your Darlings, Griffith Review, Meanjin and Overland. And in 2020, Sam was a Wheeler Centre Next Chapter Fellow. And in 2022, he co-edited Nothing to Hide, Voices of Trans and Gender Diverse Australia, which we have several contributors from that volume here tonight, and it's up for sale at the back if you're interested in purchasing. As well as these professional achievements, Sam is also a person of enormous kindness, intelligence, and integrity, as well as an indefatigable contributor to many communities. Sam often describes himself as a morose person, but I think that adjective fails to convey the knack for friendship and community that have brought so many of you here tonight. What a great turnout. I first met Sam about 4.5 years ago, and since then he's become a really cherished collaborator and friend, and I know I'm not alone in my respect and affection. A few nights ago, I spoke to Terri-Anne White, who's Sam's publisher at Upswell. Terri-Anne told me that when she sent out email requests for other writers to endorse this book, every single person she approached replied within just a few hours. And every single person said in response, "Of course, anything for Sam." And if you know anything about queers and or writers, you'll know this is very unusual behaviour. Those writers went on to pen the most enthusiastic and deserved blurbs for Detachable Penis. Chloe Hooper said, quote, "Elkin is compulsory reading, always." Fiona Kelly McGregor said, quote, "I loved this book." Eleanor Savage read it in one sitting. And there's much more else besides. You can read for yourself. Detachable Penis is Sam's first sole-authored book, but it certainly won't be the last. And in fact, he's already written a whole other manuscript. This book is a memoir about gender transition, but it's also about so many other things as well. It's a book about community legal centres and the underpaid, overworked, bleeding hearts who keep fighting the good fight. It's a meditation on the idea of queer community and a frank accounting of the ways in which we queers can play out our trauma on each other. It's a social history of a very particular moment in queer politics in the years following marriage equality. It's also a love letter to Gemma Caffarella, Sam's partner, radio co-host, and force of nature in her own right. And if that wasn't enough, it's just a damn funny good read that you'll be tempted to rip through in one or two sittings. I have no doubt that Detachable Penis will come to be known as a queer classic, no less beloved than Sam himself. It's my absolute honour to declare this book officially launched. Please join me in congratulating Sam. Sam's now going to say a few thank yous, then he and I are going to have a bit of a conversation. Then we're going to open it up to you and the audience for your questions, so get them ready. So over to Sam.
Thank you so much, Eve, and thanks so much to all of you for coming. I'm really moved by how many people have turned out for this event. I'm incredibly grateful. I wanted to start by saying thank you to the Wheeler Centre. Eve mentioned that I was a Next Chapter recipient in some year that's not this year. I think it was a pandemic year of some kind. Getting that Next Chapter Fellowship, I actually got it while I was working at the LGBTIQ Legal Service, and it really set me on my path to write this book and to write a whole number of, you know, essays and other things, and to see myself as a writer. So I'm incredibly grateful to the Wheeler Centre for that fellowship, and for also offering us this beautiful venue here tonight. It's not often that a debut writer gets like an amazing spot like this, and I'm very grateful. So thank you to the Wheeler Centre, and thank you to all the staff and volunteers that are helping this night go ahead. Thank you. I'd like to thank Terri-Anne, who is from Upswell Publishing, who took a chance on me. Some of you might know I basically pitched this on the one day of the year that Terri-Anne opens up the call for submissions with Upswell, and I was completely blown away when she accepted me. Anyone who knows anything about writing knows that it's basically rejection after rejection after rejection, and you have to get very comfy with that. And the fact that Terri-Anne picked up this manuscript, and the fact that she was a Perth-based publisher, meant a lot to me, given my ongoing Perth trauma. So thank you, Terri-Anne, and thank you to my editor, Rebecca Bowett, who edited my manuscript with a lot of care and compassion and humour, and helped me insert all the feelings I needed to insert in. So thank you, Rebecca. I'd also like to thank Hares and Hyenas, Roland up the back there, who's selling books. I love Hares and Hyenas. Roland will know that because I'm always buying books there. But, you know, when I moved to Melbourne in 2004, I very soon found my way to Hares and Hyenas and have really spent my entire life there at that bookshop. And, yeah, I'm just incredibly grateful and incredibly moved that Roland's selling my books at this event tonight. So thank you, Hares and Hyenas, for all that you do. I'd like to thank the City of Melbourne. I'm doing a wonderful residency at the moment at the Boyd Community Hub Southbank Library, and I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity to work in this weird tower thing in Southbank. It's amazing. So thank you so much for supporting me. As you'll see in my acknowledgements at the back of the book, I have so many thank yous to give that I won't be able to say on stage, but I've been incredibly well supported by the Australian literary community, whether that be Varuna, the Australian Society of Authors, Writers Victoria that's based here. I have been slurping up every opportunity possible, and I've been incredibly grateful for the support I've received. On a more informal level, my queer writers group, of which Eve's a part of, and I know many people from my queer writers group is here tonight, thank you so much. That kind of support from other writers is, incredible and necessary. And, without your, again, telling me where to insert feelings in things, I just wouldn't be able to publish anything because it would be too weird. I know many of my community law and legal aid family is here tonight. Thank you so much. Thank you especially to those of you who have been fighting for better working conditions for community lawyers through the ASU or the CPSU, or just being a great colleague. I really appreciate it. I love community law, and it means a lot to have you here. I wanted to thank just literary journals in general. This book basically comes out of a couple of essays that I wrote for the Griffith Review, for Overland, Baby Teeth and Antithesis. And, like, if they hadn't have published those works, I wouldn't have written a book. Like, it's as simple as that. So I would just say support your literary journal of choice. They really do make books happen. And, last but not least, I'd love to say thank you to Gemma, Caffarella and her whole family, Janet and Mark, thank you so much. Vanessa, Diana, thank you so much for being here tonight. I really appreciate it. You've all been so incredibly helpful in helping raise my niece Ella. Thank you. It doesn't go unnoticed. I really appreciate all of the support and the humour, and just a quiet space to hang out and not have me be the centre of attention. It means the world. So, yeah, thank you so much. And thank you, Gemma. I hope that this isn't the story cutie that you wanted, which is still on the cutting room floor. I've been meaning to write that for some time, but hopefully this book is a little taster of that story, which I've been promising to write for 5 years. thanks everybody, really appreciate it.
So, Sam, this book opens with sort of two beginnings. There's the beginning of your gender transition and the start of you working at Australia's first queer legal centre. For anyone who doesn't know the kind of background, could you give us a bit of an overview about how those two things came to coalesce?
Yeah, well, I basically decided that I wanted to medically affirm my gender in 2017 at some point. I lose track of time, but it definitely occurred as a result of watching a performance that Gemma and I watched in Sydney. It was, an incredible performance, Wild Boar, and there was a trans performer on stage, Krishna Ista, and I was just incredibly moved by their braveness in basically taking most of their clothes off on stage and being prepared to kind of celebrate their trans body on stage with a lot of humour as well, because they are a comedian. So that happened, and then like a week later I saw there was this job advert that St Kilda Legal Service put up seeking a LGBTIQ outreach lawyer, and I thought, hey, what a great idea. I've just decided to embark on this huge life change. Why not just add a new job into that,
being the face. What could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong? Yeah. So this book is a testament to what could go wrong if you try and do two things at once like that.
In my opening comments, I described this book as a kind of social history, and I know you've got a huge passion for queer history. Did you kind of consciously set out to document this very particular moment in time?
One of my kind of touchstone books is Leslie Feinberg's Stone Butch Blues. I think I might have actually originally read Ernest Price's copy of that book, who's here tonight. Thank you, Ernest. I feel like it got moved around queer share houses across Sydney and Melbourne as a sort of sacred text, because it is hard to find because it was published in the early 90s, and that book really captures a time and a place in kind of a very kind of butch femme out of suburban New York on the factory line. And I just, was incredibly moved by that book and Feinberg's ability to kind of meld their own experience of gender along with work and being a working class person, because, you know, at the end of the day, we might be trans or gender diverse people, but we also just kind of like do stuff all day, and that's a variety of different things, but it's not necessarily about like our bodies or identities. It's kind of more prosaic. So that was really an influence for me in writing this book. I don't claim to, you know, be able to kind of capture that in terms of its cult classic status, but I definitely did want to capture the place and the time, because I guess I felt like I didn't really know where we were going. I don't know where we're going, you know. I don't know if post-marriage equality, trans rights sort of hit a higher watermark and that we're going backwards, or whether we will continue to advance trans and gender diverse rights. We don't know, you know. And certainly if you look at the US and the UK, there's some signs that it might be the case that we might have a lot of fight on our hands to, even defend what we've already got. So I think it's important to capture the spirit of the time that we live in, and try and do that in a way that captures the kind of dynamic role that different organisations play, because I feel like the longer that goes on, kind of things get flattened and, you know, like winner takes all with history. And I wanted to, just share my own little piece of my life.
Yeah, I mean, you do an incredible job of bringing out the particularity of, I think, this moment and this place. It's one of the things I really enjoyed. Now, as you noted, Sam, you know, this book in a way is a kind of document of all the things that could go wrong when you combine this new job and affirming your gender. But it's also an incredibly funny book. Can you tell us about kind of using humour to navigate this sort of, you know, more challenging content?
Yeah, I don't know if that was necessarily a choice. Like, I just think that a lot of things happen that were funny. Like, I think that the LGBTIQA+ professional sector is really funny. Like, all of the infighting and drama, you know, it was a source of humour for me in what could be a difficult time, because, you know, there was some drama and a bit of shade, and you got to laugh, you know. And certainly, you know, with transitioning, like, that's a funny experience, you know. You can take it seriously, and I hope that people take our civil rights demands seriously. But also, you know, if you're a 35-year-old who's sort of going through puberty, like, that's kind of funny, you know. Like, there's a lot to laugh at in, you know, the shortcomings of at least my own nature. And, you know, in our community, like, in the trans and gender diverse community. We've got a lot of weird and wonderful people that are kind of busting the binary and doing all sorts of unexpected things, and they're sort of rubbing up against each other in all sorts of unexpected ways. And, you know, sometimes that leads to hilarious moments. So I see myself more as a documentarian than a humorist in my own right.
Okay. So you just had good material to
That's
work
right.
with.
Yeah.
I must admit, I did, as someone who's also had top surgery, love your description of the absurdity of walking around with the bags you have to wear afterwards, went to drain the blood from your chest in a little tote bag. And Sam has this great line of walking around like you're perennially in search of coffee and a newspaper, just like always walking around with a tote bag.
Yeah, yeah.
You've gestured towards, you know, some kind of tensions within the queer community. And this is one of the central themes of this book. You write about coming to the realisation that, in your words, quote, a lot of the queer community's wounds are self-inflicted. In your view, why do you think lateral violence is so prevalent in queer spaces? And why is it so hard to talk about? Like, I feel like I've never read such a frank description of it as in this book before, even though I've experienced it.
Well, in response to the first question, I think that I guess there's a sort of beige answer to that, which is that, you know, we experience higher rates of stigma and discrimination. We have consequently a higher rate of mental distress, substance misuse issues, all of that jazz, all of the sad stats. I think that as well, being part of a you know, minority community that kind of wants to do better in a whole range of ways, you know, in a range of intersectional ways, be that, you know, doing better in terms of disability justice, in terms of First Nations justice, racial justice. I think that people are, like, more aware of how things should be and are able to, you know, quite rightly articulate when things are going wrong, and as they should. But because we're such a politicised community and people are rubbing up against each other and we often don't have a lot of resources, you know, these conversations are had very stridently. And I think they should be, but it definitely has an impact when those conversations are hurtful and hurt, and, you know, when you don't have a lot of emotional capacity because of the things that are going on in your life, even when somebody's, you know, told you something in a respectful way, that you've done something wrong, that can be really hard to hear when, you know, you feel like you're on your last sort of piece of emotional reserve. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of things. I think that, you know, hurt people hurt other people as well. And I think that, you know, as queer and trans Australians, we're also not immune from the phenomenon of tall poppy syndrome. I think that's a real thing. You know, you see Americans, like, talk, you know, very kind of, like, openly about their successes and achievements and, you know, in a very kind of forthright way, and that's just not the Australian way of doing things. And I think that when people are kind of, like, put into the position of being the flavour of the month by the media, then, you know, people are quite ready to tear people down for not being perfect, which sucks. That's the response to the first question. Why is it hard to talk about? Because it's shameful. You know, if you've done something that might have been a bit wrong and somebody's response to you has been really hurtful and upsetting and might have been a bit not okay as well, it's really hard to talk about. It's a lot easier to just kind of buck up and pretend it didn't happen, or speak to you know, your own friends about it and your allies. But I think it is important to talk about the impact of lateral violence, because, you know, it makes a lot of queer and trans people, like, not want to be involved in the trans community or the queer community, and see it as a really frightening place that, you know, isn't a wonderland of peer support and, like, you know, yas queen fun times. Like, it's not like that for a lot of people. So I just kind of wanted to be honest about that, I guess.
Yeah. And yeah, I think so many people will find that really validating and meaningful to see an honest depiction of that on the page. Speaking of tensions in the queer community, I also want to talk about so-called butch erasure. You know, as you know, in this book, some have voiced anxieties about what you wonderfully call the butch to trans mask pipeline and how this is potentially leading to the disappearance of butch, you know, identities and spaces. As someone who sort of went on that pipeline yourself, what do you think is going on? Like, how should we understand this phenomenon?
Yeah, I think that, you know, society is always changing. It is in flux. So I think that, you know, for people who are born biologically as women, society has changed, like, you know, a fuckload to be, you know, Captain Obvious. Like, things have changed a lot for our situation in the last 100 years, and the possibilities that were possible for people assigned female at birth in this country alone has changed so radically and so profoundly that it's hard to even conceptualise what life was like for a person, you know, born female 100 years ago, even 50 years ago. So I think the possibilities have changed, and I think that's a really wonderful thing. I think that people all throughout history have experienced, you know, a desire to live in a different gender, have had an innate sense of being different in some ways, and that has come out very differently in different parts of society. Like, as you know, I'm a real stan for Edward de Lacy Evans and history of sort of 19th century proto-trans masculinity in colonial Victoria. It's something that I'm really interested in. And, you know, somebody like that would have had an entirely different experience of their life and understanding of their own body and gender experience. And we really can't find that now. We can only speculate. So things are always changing. I have a lot of nostalgia, you know, because I'm 40, so I'm just, like, I'm prime nostalgia age. I've got a lot of nostalgia for my, you know, early 20s when sort of, you know, Katie Lang, Ellen DeGeneres, you know, these were the people that I kind of, like, grew up with, and it was, you know, being butch was a real source of shame. Like, it was a really shameful thing to be, and being called butch, like, was not a good thing, like, at all. And, you know, I was denigrated as being, like, a butch dyke, like, my, you know, entire experience of high school and university. And so, yeah, like, it's with a sense of sadness that I no longer inhabit that category, because it's a category that meant a lot to me and that, you know, kept me safe and the whole kind of, like, lesbian and queer women community. Like, that's how I grew up. That's where I got my political education. That's where all my cultural references are from, you know. And when I look at people who inhabit that category, I'm like you. But, you know, they look at me and they don't think the same thing. You know, my fault, my bad. You know, I can't blame anybody else for that. But, yeah, it's a melancholy thing to, you know, I guess it's like moving countries. Like, you might have had a reason to do it, but you still kind of miss what home was like. Perhaps it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. Well, speaking of being nostalgic for your early 20s, one of the things I really love about this book is the way you write, with great insight but a lot of empathy for the differences between, you know, and potential tensions between different queer and trans generations. And, you know, as you've sort of noted, you're an elder millennial, you've just turned 40 last year, you came out as queer in the 90s but then, you know, transitioned in the late 2010s. So I think, you know, it seems like that experience has made you able to relate to queers both a lot older and a lot younger than yourself. These days, like, where do you, what generation do you feel like you belong to? Do you feel like you have a generational home?
Well, you know, I grew up pretty fast, having a spectacularly dysfunctional family. So I see myself as a baby Gen Xer.
Not an elder name, millennial.
Maybe a geriatric millennial. yeah, somewhere along that. So that's definitely the world that I feel, you know, most comfortable with. When I came to age sort of like politically, genderqueer was the term that was used, you know, and we don't really use that anymore. And I think that, yeah, once you've seen language change a few times and terminology become in vogue and then go out of vogue, you perhaps have a bit more sympathy for, you know, people who are in their 60s or 70s being like, well, back in my day we called them transsexuals and that's what I want to say, you know, like you have a bit more sympathy for that. So, yeah, like I'm really inspired by young people. I'm spun out by what life is like and I feel sorry for them most of the time because financially they're getting really fucked over and like the internet has destroyed us all. So... yeah, I've got a lot of sympathy. You know, I'm glad that I grew up in a generation where I couldn't be shamed on social media when I went to school because I certainly would have been constantly. So, yeah, when I think about young people, you know, I try and, you know, just follow what they're doing because they seem to have a much more inclusive way of doing things. They seem to have dropped a lot of the really toxic parts of our culture. You know, they seem to be drinking less, shame about the smoking. But, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm fascinated by what each generation does with gender and, you know, with politics, yeah.
Do you think queer generations happen more quickly?
Well, I mean, there's a kind of... there's a notion that... you know, to be queer is to kind of, in a way, inhabit a, like, Peter Pan-esque identity for a lot of people. This is, of course, not true for everybody, but a lot of queer people won't hit the same markers of time in the traditional way that heterosexual people will. So they might not get married, or if they do, it'll be much later because, hey, you know, marriage equality was only passed a few years ago. They might, you know, have children at some point or they may not. They may have children much later in life because, you know, they might have to save up like $50,000 to go through IVF or whatever. So I think, and, you know, particularly if you've been alienated from your family of origin, you know, it can just make the everyday experience of life harder. So, you know, getting the loan from the bank of mum and dad might not be possible. So, you know, not to say that any of us can afford the cost of living these days, but, you know, if you've been, alienated from your family of origin, it can make it very difficult to hit those, you know, traditional markers, buying a house, you know, having an ongoing full-time job, like what even is that now? And particularly if you've, you know, a minority, you're even less likely to have that. So I do think queers definitely exist in a sort of non-linear queer time, which I love about the queer and trans community.
And speaking of this sort of, you know, your evolution from a kind of butch identity in butch communities, you also write with great insight and humour about the strangeness of kind of acquiring male privilege as an adult and, you know, realising that all of a sudden, you know, people will step away from you on the street and listen to you in meetings and all these things that had never happened before. What did that kind of strange experience of, you know, going from being read as a butch lesbian to a kind of straight man teach you about the operation of patriarchy and misogyny in everyday life?
Yeah, I guess it taught me that I think that, you know, if you're read as female, you kind of have this sense, like, that society is sort of telling you, like, oh, everything's fine for women now, at least in a country like this and in Melbourne in particular, like, we're fine now. You know, sure, the gender pay gap might not have quite been sorted out, but, like, everything's basically fine, so shut up. And, yeah, going through a transition and sort of experiencing male privilege, like, I'm definitely here to say that is not true. You know, the way that women are kind of shamed and undermined and put down and had their confidence shot in, like, every aspect of life, from, like, getting a coffee to talking in a meeting to, you know, getting on public transport, like, it is really hard to convey how pervasive it is. You know, it's a wonderful thing to have the red carpet sort of metaphorically rolled out for you. You know, that is nice, but, like, every interaction you have with anybody, it's like, you might not have been nice to me, you know, like 7 years ago, so how am I supposed to understand this now? So it is a strange experience and one that I haven't fully kind of squared out in my mind. But yeah, I mean, I was definitely like a feminist before, but I definitely remain very much a feminist now after having experienced, you know, going to the sort of other side of sex apartheid and realising all the attendant benefits of being on the other side.
I want to talk as well about community legal centres, which is another big theme of this book, and I know kind of a passion of yours. You know, as you depict, they're not getting the resources and the funding they need. Like, what's your vision for a properly resourced community legal centre sort of sector?
Oh, yes. Well, this is very topical given that it's budget time.
Yeah.
I'm sure that we're not going to see a massive injection in funding to community legal centres and legal aids across the country, but we really should. You know, it's just bizarre. Like, even when I was working as a sort of country lawyer in Morwell, working at Legal Aid, you know, some of my colleagues switched to the other side. They got a job at the Department of Public Prosecutions instead, and they got immediately like a 30% pay rise, you know, and they're still working in the government sector. So these are kind of government jobs, but the inequality of pay is just so extreme. And basically, if you're, you know, attempting to serve a minority community, whether they be poor, you know, a minority religion or minority gender, you basically have to accept getting paid a lot less for your entire career. And when you're, you know, 25 to 30, like, maybe that's not a priority for you because you want to fight the good fight and that's what you want to do. But then, you know, when you get into your kind of late 30s, you start to think, wow, like, super, like, what about that? And, you know, you start to think, like, I actually can't live like this. And I think that so many people have kind of grudgingly had to make a decision to step out of that space for financial reasons. And it's terrible because, you know, it leads to a loss of experience and, you know, leadership for the next generation. And, yeah, so many people I know that have been, you know, trained as first-class lawyers have done so in community legal centres and aren't there anymore. And, you know, like the private sector or working as barristers or, you know, working for other organisations, they are reaping the benefits of it, and it's really unfair. And, you know, it's unfair for lawyers, but the flow-on effect, of course, is it's unfair for people that need it. You know, every time the government makes a bad, you know, decision like robo-debt, for example, or like the entire way the NDIS scheme has been rolled out, you know, hundreds of thousands of people suffer, and then there's sort of like 120 or whatever, like lawyers and, you know, administrative staff that work for CLCs that are like trying to deal with that in each state. It's absurd when you think about the level of need and how it's not being met, and then on top of it, the government does all of these egregious things. So, yeah, I mean, the obvious answer is more funding and, like, a more compassionate government that does less horrific things to, you know, new migrants and refugees and so on. But, you know, I would love to see a CLC sector where people can actually work in that career for life, mm-hmm. unless they happen to be somebody who, you know, has the financial backing of family that means that they can make a kind of not purely economic decision to do that.
So this book sort of, this might be a bit of a spoiler, but it ends with you leaving the law, but you've recently come back to the law, yes. I believe.
Yeah, come back. yeah, oops.
Yeah. Tell us about that. What lured you back?
You know, I've always really loved community law, and I've always really loved LGBTIQA community and the sector. I definitely decided that I couldn't do both ever again. That was too much. But yeah, I've recently come back to work in the community legal sector, working in like mental health law, which is something that I'm also really interested in, but I'm not so personally affected by. So I think, I hope that that's going to be a career choice that's going to lead to, you know, me being able to do work that is meaningful and that I care about, but that doesn't have all of the kind of difficulties of, you know, ending up at a professional event and then your entire community is there and then people messaging you on Facebook and trying to get legal advice and stuff. So, yeah, I'm trying to kind of crab walk back into the legal centre but without so much of the trauma this time.
Good luck.
Sorry. We'll see.
This, as we've said, Detachable Penis is your first book, but you've been writing for many years, you know, first privately, but you've also been publishing essays for a long time. Can you give us a bit of a window into the development of your writing craft over that period?
Yeah. I tried to start writing my coming-of-age memoir, which I'm still working on, when I was 23, so that's going back 17 years ago. My first creative writing class was when I was 19 at Curtin Uni. So, yeah, I've been trying to write for, you know, 21 years now. I finished that manuscript and decided that it was bad, but I was glad that I'd done it, you know, and I think that a lot of people will have that experience of being like, this is trash, but, you know, it's great to get to the end. It's really hard to get to the end of something and there's something in that. I think when I started to take my work sort of a bit more seriously is when I was, you know, I was lucky enough to come second in this very short creative writing competition that this group called LGBTIQ Outstanding Stories runs, which I think is part of Mardi Gras somehow, and I won like $100 or something, you know, which obviously isn't a huge sum of money, but having that recognition, even though I didn't even win, was immense, you know, like it was amazing to just have any form of recognition. So I'm incredibly grateful to the people that, you know, run those competitions because they do help you to see yourself as a serious writer and put in the time, because there's so many reasons to not write, like apart from the fact that it's, you know, often difficult and painful. Like, you know, we have to work all day, most of us. There are other things to do. There's a lot of reasons to not write, and you know, taking the time to do that, you know, requires people believing in you. And even those tiny, you know, moments where a literary journal picks up your piece could be incredibly transformative. It was really literary journals where I got my start. I think I wrote about 4 articles for Overland Literary Journal. I started writing about community law stuff because birth certificate law reform was going on in Victoria at the time. So I wrote you know, a sort of personal essay kind of riffing on that stuff in Overland, and wrote about the tragic murder of Melody Bruno, who was part of the trans community as well. And, yeah, Overland's just an amazing journal that publishes a lot of great stuff. So I was really inspired to write for Overland, and, you know, I always read Overland. The two pieces that form the spine of this book were picked up by the Griffith Review. So I just pitched cold what became the sad stats, the trauma of community law, which was a piece about, which is a scene in the book running LGBTIQ inclusion training and wondering whether it was sort of like reinforcing the trauma of our community and using a kind of deficit model to try and seek services, whether that was doing something bad or something good, which I still don't really know the answer to. And then they picked up another piece, which is also called Detachable Penis, and that was about me trying to square away my experiences of having, you know, the experience of living in a world where I'm now treated as male but having a body that looks different, and what the fuck you meant to do with that. So they were the two kind of spine pieces of this book, and, yeah, I definitely wouldn't have written this book without their support and their, the ability to edit my work, because I really did and do have a problem with inserting emotions into my writing. So the hard work of editors very diplomatically being like, and how did you feel? Like, was, really, really helpful, and I still need that help, but maybe I'm getting a bit better at it.
I think you're getting better. We'll go to audience questions in a moment. But before that, I'm interested to know, like, who are the writers you admire and, you know, want to emulate? Who are your kind of literary icons as you've, you know, been through this process of developing your own writing career?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is on my mind because we're both doing that Charlotte Wood thing for Melbourne Writers Festival later this week on creative ambition of writing with risk. And this was one of the questions, like, who do you admire? And it took me a while to think about that. But one person who I really admire is Kat Fitzpatrick, who is a Brooklyn-based trans woman and runs a publishing house, a micro publishing house called Little Puss Press. She wrote a really awesome book called The Call Out, a novel in rhyme, which I would really highly recommend. It's literally a novel in rhyme, which is something that I would never pick up. I'm not very ambitious in my taste a lot of the time, but this book is basically this hilarious take on like the queer and trans community in Brooklyn and going to you know, social protest events and community organizing and putting on literary events and then drama. And yeah, I love Kat Fitzpatrick. I had the pleasure of interviewing her on our radio show, Queer View Mirror, and I was just like, wow, I want to be like you. You know, she's writing these incredible books. She's doing so much community organising. You know, she runs that press, publishing stuff that just wouldn't get published otherwise. You know, it's incredible, like, how much work an individual publisher can do in transforming the literary landscape. And, you know, I follow her on Instagram. She's always running these very DIY events at her house with, like, new and emerging trans writers in the States that I sometimes tune into because they just Instagram live it in a very kind of DIY way. And I'm, yeah, if there's somebody who I'm inspired by, it's her not just her craft, but her desire to bring everybody along with her. She's not interested in, you know, individual success. She's interested in community success and raising the profile of other authors. And, yeah, like, I hope I can emulate that in my career.
I think you're doing a pretty good job so far. We'll go now to audience questions. We've got some roving mics with the ushers. Anyone have any questions?
Hi, Sam. I'm here for a few reasons, but one's the title.
Okay.
And I just want to know at what point you realised that was the one.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I did name a essay in the Griffith Review, Detachable Penis, Gender Dismembered, and that felt a little lower stakes because, you know, as much as I love the Griffith Review, it is, yeah, not something that your work colleague is going to ask you about necessarily unless they happen to be into, you know, the cutting edge of Australian publishing. It's been, yeah, really embarrassing having to tell people what the book's called over and over again. Terri-Ann loved the title, I think for obvious reasons, like it reminds people of the King Missile song. So it's got the nostalgia value of that horrific earworm track. I definitely had a moment where I wanted to back out of calling it that because I was just like, I can't have a book come out and my name forever be associated with Detachable Penis, because anybody who knows me knows, like, I'm actually a real prude and, like, not really an out-there person at all. But, you know, I think that it kind of does what I wanted to do in that it talks about the fact that it's about trans stuff but funny. So hopefully
trauma light
the title reflects that.
Do you want to tell the story of the cover image as well?
So the cover is a crochet packer. So I bought this from a Narm-based artist whose Instagram name anyway is Bretty Bo Betty, who's really great. He does gay life drawing classes. Definitely recommend you go along to them. And I just thought it was, like, really funny you know, it was a difficult time. You know, I ordered it during one of the COVID-19 lockdowns, and when we were just ordering stuff online all the time as a way of connecting with broader society. And yeah, the packer actually got lost in the mail. Like, it just got lost, and it was just like, could anything more embarrassing be lost in the mail? Like, where is it? What's going to happen to it? What journey is this thing going to go on? Where is it now? You know, like, you wouldn't throw it out. Like, I was like, did it end up being somebody's, like, Christmas decoration? Like, I still don't know. So, yeah, Brady was kind enough to make me a second one very diligently. This is a bespoke item, so it took him another 6 weeks to do it. Yeah, he has really suffered for me in this book, because now his beautiful artwork is on the cover. And, yeah, again, like, even though in many ways I'm horrified by what I've done, I feel like it adequately sums up the kind of humour aspect of the book that I was hoping to go for. So, yeah, I still don't know whether it's going to repel or attract people to buy the book. So, yeah, I'm sure Terri-Ann will tell me 6 months in whether it's my decisions have been a commercial flop or not. We'll see.
Well, I think Brady by Betty might get inundated with orders now.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Any more questions? We've got time for one or two more. Yep.
Hi, Sam. I really enjoyed reading your book. But I was wondering, can you tell me more about the dedication?
Oh, to the little gay kids of Werribee. Yeah. That's actually a quote from Gemma, my partner, who's sitting at the front here. It is a bit of an in-joke. So when the Victoria Pride Centre was still being conceived of, there was a lot of discussion and debate about where the Pride Centre would go. Very long and checkered history, which you can hear about, but the City of Port Phillip offered that land, as far as I understand it, like, for free. So it ended up going in St Kilda, and it's there now. You can go there. I was there just the other day. I'm always there. Love the Pride Centre. But, yeah, there was, I think, a fairly, like, valid critique being, like, from Gemma, how are the little gay kids of Werribee going to get to the Pride Centre in St Kilda? It's not very local. So, yeah, I guess the dedication is sort of talking a bit about... like, I'm from the outer suburbs of Perth. I do think about, you know, what outer suburban young people are experiencing, and, like, hoping that, you know, when we have these moments of quote-unquote sort of, like, trans equality and moments of pride, that that extends out to the end of the train line, because, you know, in my life anyway, it definitely didn't as a young person. And you know, I think that we should be thinking about offering services, yeah, at the ends of the train lines and beyond, and not just at the Pride Centre, though. Love the Pride Centre. no issue. Yeah.
Hi, Sam. Accounting for, like, LGBTIQ history and documenting experiences and people's names, did you find it useful also having a legal background to avoid any defamation suits? I've played that game of opening the book to find a spot, and I saw the comment about, does the LGBTIQ community actually exist, or is it just CEOs making it up to be able to fight for funding? And I thought, I think I've said that before as well.
Sorry, plagiarism.
No. But can you talk a bit more about that? Because I think that's important, because we're, like, in this neoliberal kind of society where people are fighting for funding, and can we be grouped into, like, an economic kind of funding package? And, you know, I think that's important. You've obviously experienced an interface with these conversations, and the book, when I read it, will probably explain more about how legal services is an example of that, those competitive tendering and the environments that we work in and our communities kind of are affected by that, and you've obviously been around and exposed to that.
Yeah, well, it was an absurd proposition in a way, trying to serve the LGBTIQ community, as it was then known in 2017, because, you know, within the first sort of week of me starting, you know, Health Justice Partnership at a queer health service, it became clear that, like, who are we talking about? You know, there are, you know, gay and bi men who, you know, may have issues with HIV, for example. They may have issues with, you know, drug misuse, criminal charges stemming from things like that. Like, that was a community that was identified that had legal issues. Then there was, like, you know, queer bi women who had children, for example, who were dealing with, you know, messy family court issues and messy family violence issues and issues accessing gender-affirming healthcare for the young people in their lives, you know, in outer suburban and regional areas. Like, that was a sort of cohort that I could identify, not to say that everybody was the same. You know, there was the trans and gender-diverse community that had, you know, a whole bunch of issues like ID change issues, stigma and discrimination in employment, you know. That was a cohort that you could identify. Then as an overlay on top of that, there was, like, everybody who happened to inhabit one of those identities who had a disability, who might be wanting to access the NDIS or might be wanting to get on the disability support pension and be excluded by that. Like, that's a whole other overlay. And they're just sort of some examples of the different communities. Yeah, not to mention the sort of political and, you know, social justice priorities of the intersex communities who are, you know, fighting to prevent medically unnecessary, you know, surgical interventions on infants. Like, that's a huge political issue and a legal issue that, you know, deserves and requires its own space and time. So the idea that we're, like, one community that, you know, that you could provide an outreach service for, like, we don't live in the same area, you know, like, the kind of people... we're not in a ghetto, you know, like, there are communities, like, there's a big community of queer women and trans folk up in, like, Reservoir, for example, you know, there is the, like, Southside, you know, gay kind of community and, like, the much older trans women community, like, there's sex worker trans communities that work and live out in Dandenong, you know, like, we're everywhere, we're all over the place, and that's not including Footscray where I live, you know, like, so... Yeah, it is a kind of absurdity to try and create this notion of there being one community, because there's, like, thousands of communities, and then within that there's lots of people that don't get along with each other. Do you know what I mean? Like, the more you're like somebody, the less you are to get along with them, you know, it seems, in my experience. So, yeah, then there's these organisations who, you know, I understand, like, I've written a grant application in my life. Like, you have to tick a box of what community you're planning on serving, and it's like this construction of capitalism and the way that our funding is allocated that we have to say, oh, I'm going to serve this particular community at this particular time, and, you know, who's the right person to do that, you know, historically. I think we've seen here in, you know, Victoria and in a lot of Western countries that traditionally the LGBTIQ organisations, as they're branded now, tend to be led by cisgender gay men who have, you know, been harmed and affected by the AIDS pandemic and have built up really strong sexual health services and counselling services, and there's much to admire about that. But yeah, like, handing over control to, like, other communities is not necessarily their strong suit. So, there's, you know, political issues within the so-called LGBTIQ community that I least wanted to point out in some way. But yeah, there was so many parts of this book that ended up on the cutting room floor because I was like, my publisher was like, you can't put that in there. I think I was less risk averse about defamation than my publisher was. So I think that Terri-Anne has helped me craft a more generous book than it may have been in its earlier iteration. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's on the hard drive. Yeah.
Well, on that note, we might need to end the formalities this evening, but I think if you give Sam enough drinks, he might give you the redacted version of the manuscript. Please stick around, and we've got the booksellers, Hares and Hyenas, up the back. They'll be selling copies of Sam's book. Sam will be there signing with a handy little sign next to him, which you'll see in a moment. So please stick around and get your book signed. Stay for another drink and milling. But it's so wonderful to see you all here tonight. I knew Sam was more than morose. I knew Sam was wonderful at building communities and friendship, and you guys have really proved it by churning out tonight. So please join me again in celebrating the publication of Sam Elkin's Detachable Penis.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Eve Rees in conversation with Sam Elkin. The event was recorded on Monday, the 6th of May, 2024, at the Wheeler Centre. The official bookseller was Hares and Hyenas. The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news, and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.